You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Tamara here, your host and finisher of three Tough Mudders so far. So why am I even mentioning Tough Mudder, a grueling event where I paid really good money to crawl through electric shock wires over and over again? Because sometimes I feel like that's what being an entrepreneur is too. You just keep signing up for the pain and hopefully the reward. So someone asked me why I get up every day and put myself through that, and it got me thinking. So I asked Michael Wolff, who I've met personally before. He's a serial entrepreneur and founder of Gladly, a very successful startup in the customer service space. I asked him to come onto Launch Street for a chat about just that. I think you'll find his comments about why he keeps coming back for more and how he takes quote-unquote breaks between fascinating. Also, listen for how he talks about the mindset behind taking risks, adding value, and driving success. It might give you some insight into how you tackle your next big, messy project, business, or idea. All right, let's do this. Mike, thank you so much for joining me today. This is our second conversation, but it's nice to talk to you again.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to digging in. So let's start letting people get to know you. What's one thing people would be absolutely surprised to learn about you, you know, hobby, passion, experience?
Yeah, well, I think I'm one of these unusual people who keeps coming back for more in terms of starting companies. So I'm working on my fifth startup right now, and people ask me a lot, don't you run out of steam or get exhausted, or don't you get tired doing this? And my secret has been that I take breaks between companies. So I'm one of these people where I don't want to work hard until I'm old and then retire. I want to take my retirement, break it up into little one-year chunks, and take time off in between jobs. So I've been pretty lucky because about the last 20 years, I've managed to work really hard on a company for a few years. Then I spent 6 months in Europe with my wife once. Then I worked hard on my next company. Then we took a summer off, another company. Then we spent about a year and a half mostly living in Barcelona before I started this last company. And the kids went to school there. We traveled every weekend. So, you know, work hard, play hard. I think that's something we kind of all aspire to. Like I've managed to actually do it. Like I've managed to actually get time off in between. And honestly, you kind of have to, because startups are so hard that if you tried to, you know, leave one on a Friday and start the next one on a Monday, you know, you would never survive.
Right. Well, I have to ask you, and I think there's really two questions, but they go hand in hand. So I'm going to ask you both of them because this is fascinating to me. So one is, where did you get the idea for this? And my second question on top of that is, when you're taking your break, are you ever afraid that you're not going to be relevant when you come back? And I know you a little bit, so I know it sounds like a little bit of a silly question, but I don't know. There's a part of me that goes, oh my gosh, like if you're not in the game, someone else is going to take your place. So I'd love to hear kind of how you started doing this and your take on that break.
Yeah, well, so let me ask that second question first, and then we'll jump into kind of the Gladly background because it's all connected. I worry a lot about getting out of date. I mean, in this industry, you can be away for 12 months and come back and you've kind of missed not just a generation of ideas and technology, but a generation of people.
Yeah.
You know, people come and go. And if your network's not fresh, and especially if your network isn't current on people who are kind of coming into the industry straight out of college or people in their 20s usually, you can very easily get disconnected from it. And in fact, even if you're at a startup, you can often go so deep in that startup and all the issues and complications that you have with your product and your customers, that you kind of lose track of the rest of the industry and what's going on over in other markets and other people. So a couple things I've tried to do. One is I just tend to geek out on the industry. I read the news. I hang out with people, like, you know, networking. I just try to stay current. The other thing I did is while I was in Europe, even though I mostly took it as a vacation and spent a lot of time with my family, I taught at a business school there. I spoke at conferences. I joined some advisory boards. I became a venture partner at Point Nine Capital, which is a great seed fund in Berlin. So really took it as an opportunity to really figure out what's happening with startups and entrepreneurship in Europe, which first of all has just a lot of great companies. It feels a lot like Silicon Valley did, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. a lot of people starting companies for the right reason who are really, really committed. Also, a lot of those folks, as their companies grow, they end up moving to San Francisco or at least putting an office here. So you kind of see those companies come full circle. So I've really deliberately made an effort to say, hey, just working in technology is actually not enough to stay current. You have to work constantly to get to know people, read and study and stay on top of it.
You know, for launch tweeters listening out there, I just want you to take a moment and think about how you can take a break from the daily grind and go and learn more about your category and what you do and what's, I think, Mike, you're also saying like what's outside your category that you can bring back as well. Just so cool to think about it that way.
And I have a lot of advantages. I'm right in the middle of San Francisco. I think there's 20 startups in my building. I mean, I'm surrounded by technology and innovation. But even then, unless you actively go and fill in the gaps of your knowledge and stay current, it's very easy to kind of lose track of what's happening in the industry.
And do you think sometimes, too, when you're so deep in it, you don't even see the gaps that you have because you're just so busy in the day-to-day, whether you're in a startup or a big company, don't you find that to be true?
Yeah, I mean, especially as companies grow, and this even happens at startups as they grow, your focus tends to get narrower and narrower where it's, what's my company? What's my market? What's going on with my team? Are my customers happy? And that always should be your top priority because there's no point of being savvy about the tech industry if your company's not working. But often, even when a company gets to be 3 or 4 years old, which is where we are right now, stuff starts to happen in other companies and other industries that you can look at and be inspired by. And you can say, hey, you know, that's going to hit our market or my company pretty quickly. It's best to hear about those things through your own customers because if your customers say, hey, I talked to this really interesting company, you guys should look at them, you always want to pay attention to that. So your first priority should always be the thing you're trying to do. But it's very easy to get so heads down that you miss, not just for your own career, you miss opportunities, but you even miss opportunities to bring new things to your own customers.
So I have to ask, so you've been a part of, I think, the initial team of 5 startups, if I heard you right.
Yeah, either founder or first or second employee, yeah.
Yep. What keeps you coming back for more? So if it's exhausting and you need a break, what keeps you coming back?
There's something that happens at a startup that's really, really working that really doesn't happen very many other places in life. First of all, you're part of a team of people who are taking something that never existed in the world and you're trying to make it happen. And you're seeing that progress. You're saying, hey, this was just an idea on the back of a napkin a year ago. Now we have live customers. We have people paying us money. We have investors. So that feeling of progress and creativity and creation really doesn't exist very many other places. Also, when a company is really working, the people who work at the company, not only are they enjoying the ride in terms of just being part of something that's successful, kind of like being on a winning sports team, that you're seeing their careers develop really, really quickly. I mean, I've seen people graduate from college and, you know, this is their first job. And, you know, 3 years later, they're managing teams, they're selling to companies, their skill sets have been upgraded. They even might leave and start their own company someday. So seeing you actually change people's lives, not just financially if the company is successful, but seeing what they can do after they've been through kind of an intense startup experience where there's lots of focus on training and letting people do things for the first time, it's very addictive when it's working. Now, when it's not working, and unfortunately most startups don't work, so there's probably more people who have gone through that experience, it's pretty hard. It still can be really fun, and it can be fun to say, hey, if this company fails, we'll go try it again. I've been pretty lucky in that my first few companies they kind of got to critical mass of a few hundred people and millions in revenue, and they worked. And that's really, really fun. And when you're not in that, you miss it. And when I take these vacations between companies, usually about halfway through, I get really excited to, okay, it's great to take time off, but wow, I wonder what my next thing is going to be. Like, how do I get back to be part of one of these high-performing teams? Because it's so much fun when it works.
Maybe that's when you know it's the right thing for you, right? It's kind of like when you look forward to Monday, something's working.
Exactly.
Right?
But exactly. And you might not look forward to every Monday, right? But if you don't look forward to most of them, then you might be in the wrong place.
Well, let me ask you this, though, because you had said there's something, I think, magical about being in a startup that's working. But you also said, right, the truth, which is a lot of them don't work. So what is the difference from your kind of years of experience from the ones that work to the ones that don't?
There's no way to answer that question completely. I think any question that would make you a billionaire if you knew the answer is by definition a question that nobody has a great answer to. Obviously, this is what venture capitalists spend their time doing is how do I, you know, figure out what's going to work and what's not going to work. And there certainly is an aspect of luck to it, but I think that it's probably less about luck and more about timing. You can pretty easily see a company working today that maybe wouldn't have worked if somebody started it last year. And you can look at a company like YouTube or even a company like Snapchat, and you can find 10 other companies that tried to do something similar around the same time. They just kind of nailed the timing as well as the execution. So timing is a big factor. I think something that the industry calls founder market fit, which is the founding team of the company in combination of this particular idea, is an especially good fit. The founders didn't just brainstorm ideas on a whiteboard and pick something that sounded plausible. They actually went after a market that they knew something about, maybe an industry they worked in before, maybe something that they have a particular passion of or some insight into. Because the thing that sustains you at a startup, especially early on, is really wanting to solve the problem. It's not going to be any financials or any outside support, because you're not going to get a whole lot. So that founders being passionate and interested about the problem they're solving is a big one. And the next one is really, it's just plain old execution. Startups are really 90% execution and 10% inspiration and idea. And you have to be able to hire a great team who just cranks stuff out and gets stuff done, makes course corrections along the way, communicates with each other open and honestly. There's really no substitute for execution, and it's pretty hard to find a startup success story where those first 10 or 20 employees at the company weren't just incredible at what they did, worked really hard, and just got stuff done.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that, because as I was thinking about that, it's 90% execution. I totally agree. I think sometimes in the media, you know, what we put on the pedestal is the ideation, the aha moment. So yeah. That's what we see as like, oh my God, that's what it means to be an entrepreneur and a startup. That's what it means to have the breakthrough idea. But I'm sure you've seen a ton of brilliant ideas fall short because the execution sucked.
Yeah. And plus, you never really know if they're brilliant ideas. I mean, if somebody pitched you the idea for Twitter, or if somebody pitched you the idea for Airbnb, you would do what almost everybody who heard those ideas in the early days.
No, too dangerous. Wouldn't do that. No.
And say that doesn't make any sense. Like, who's going to get in? Like, Uber, it would be who is going to get into a stranger's car. Amazon, it was, well, who's going to put their credit card number on the web? So good ideas often sound like bad ideas, and you don't even know until a couple of years in, even if that company is going to make it. So it's hard to know at the outset if an idea is good, but if you have a team who seems to know a lot about it, really, really into it, seems to have some insights into what it's going to take to make it work, often you're on the right track, and a great team can even turn an idea that's small into a really big one.
You know, one of my favorite stories, just to highlight your point, that I share often when I keynote is about Tough Mudder, which Will Dean, one of the founders, submitted to a Harvard business competition, and they told him it would never work and that he would never have a market for that. And he took $6,000, Facebook ad, did his first event, and now they're a multi-billion dollar company across the globe. So, well, I think it really highlights that until you put it into market and test it too, you don't really know, yeah. I think, to your point.
Yeah, I mean, you could look at Allbirds, you could look at Warby Parker, you could look at SoulCycle. Good ideas almost by definition have a contrarian kind of focus to them, because otherwise everybody would have already done them.
Right. And there'd be no space for it in the marketplace too.
Yeah, exactly. That doesn't mean all ideas are good. Most ideas, but most people who are contrarians are wrong. being a contrarian and being right is what gets you there. And even then, a lot of people don't know if they're right until they're 2 or 3 years into it. And, you know, I don't know if the first Tough Mudder event was a success or not, but my guess is it took them a bunch of tries before they really got the formula. But then they were off to the races.
You don't do one right and then suddenly everything's perfect and working. You do one, mm-hmm. You learn, you see what works, what doesn't, and you go from there. Let's talk a little bit about Gladly, though, because one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you is what you're doing out there is trying to revolutionize a category. So will you talk a little bit about what you do and what you're trying to accomplish with it?
So what Gladly is trying to solve is – we are selling to mostly B2C companies, so hotels, airlines, retailers, banks, anybody who's got millions and millions of consumers that they are supporting. And the problem we're solving for them are a couple things. One is that the expectations of consumers in terms of when you talk to a company, first of all, do they answer your questions? Does that company have good customer service? Does the person you talk to actually know who you are? You know, we've all had that experience when you call a company and they ask you to repeat yourselves. Yeah. They ask you to, you say, oh, I talked to somebody yesterday.
Here's my case number. I don't know.
Yeah, they ask you for your case number, and that feels terrible because, yeah. Do you really want to be a case number? Shouldn't they know your name? So, and also, there's companies out there like Amazon and Apple, and every industry has folks who are really setting the bar high for customer service. For example, in the airline industry, JetBlue, who is one of our first customers, they've won the J.D. Power Award for customer service in their segment for, I think, 14 years in a row. There's companies like that that have really set the bar high for consumers, and consumers' patience for companies that don't do a great job in service generally is going down. It's also becoming just how companies have to differentiate. The second thing is that at a technical level, the way that consumers talk to companies, it's no longer pick up the phone and call the 800 number or go to the website and fill out a form and hit the send button and hope somebody answers you. You want to be able to talk to somebody on your mobile device. It could be over a text message. It could be Twitter or Facebook. It could even be in the mobile app of the company you're doing business with. You want control over what that channel is. If you're in the mobile app, it's always funny when you push a button for help and the mobile app tells you to call the 800 number. I want help right there.
Right. That's why I'm in the app.
Yeah. And the person who then has to help me should know that I was in the app. They should know what my last question was. They should know my customer information. So that sounds, that's something that very few companies have actually accomplished, and partially because this is an industry which is very much driven by legacy technology. It's products that mostly handle a single communication channel. So a lot of this industry is people who will help you answer your phones and route your calls when somebody calls the 800 number, or somebody who can help you answer your emails. And one of my previous companies, my second startup about 20 years ago, was a company called Kana, which helped companies handle email, chat, kind of website interaction. And this was back in the late 90s when the problems that companies were dealing with was they went from not having a website to having a website.
Right.
Which tells you a little bit about how long I've been doing this.
Just to date yourself.
and they had to take that customer interaction that they had previously been happening on the phone or in the store and bringing that online. And we still see those solutions from the 90s, the phone solutions, the email solutions, the chat solutions, still in production when we go to a customer and look over their shoulder and see what they're using. So what we're doing is bringing that all together. We're moving it to the cloud, which gives you a bunch of opportunities in terms of making this a subscription business, making it easier for companies to deploy these products. We're bringing all the communication channels into one place. We're also giving a great experience to that agent who you're talking to. We've all had experiences calling companies or emailing companies or chatting with agents and companies, and they don't seem real happy with their jobs, or they don't seem like they're very, and they have trouble being helpful because of it. Part of that is that the tools they're using, it's almost like you're back in the mainframe era. If you give somebody something that's super easy to get trained on, has kind of consumer web and consumer social and mobile type interfaces, and tells them what they need to know to give you the best help, the best help that they can, it makes a huge difference, both in, just in terms of being able to recruit and keep the best people to help consumers.
So it sounds like, I'm just kind of processing what you're saying, there's kind of two issues going on. One is, you've got customers with completely different expectations. And I can't remember if it was you at the conference where we met or somebody else who said that you're only as good as your customer's last expectation. Only as good as your customer's last experience. So that's what you're being compared to. And if you've got a really great experience and then I come to you and it's really crappy, even if you're in completely different categories, right? That's what I'm comparing you to. So that's on the outside. And then on the inside, you've got people with legacy systems, so they're not even set up to succeed.
Right. And it's, consumers are comparing you to their experience at other companies or other industries. Also, because of social, if they have a bad experience, or if you have a customer service, there's an issue like a lot of companies have, like a lot of airlines especially have had these lately, those end up in the media and spread extremely quickly. And your ability to set a good reputation at your company for having great service, that can go away with a single incident that makes the news.
Right.
So just the bar continues to go up. So customers, they're making big investments here.
So let me ask you this. You know, you're in a world, as you said, with a lot of legacy systems, things that have been the same for 20 plus years, maybe a little bit of resistance to change. Why take that on? And what kind of lessons have you had along the way in doing that?
First of all, it does work. You know, even if you look inside of a company and you're frustrated by the amount of legacy that they have, good companies do make changes. And that's why they're spending $1 trillion a year in information technology investments. You know, they are doing a lot. It can be a little bit difficult at a startup in that, you know, especially when you're mostly selling to large enterprise, which is what we're doing. We only want to sell to the bigger companies who have millions of consumers that they're supporting. You have to find, first of all, companies that are innovative, the companies that want to be at least in the first half of their market in terms of moving to the next generation of systems, giving consumers, you know, the next generation of experiences. And you need to get into them at the right time. You need to get into them when they're considering doing one of these projects, so you're in early enough to help shape that direction and become part of it. So inside the company, we spend a lot of time saying, what's the right target for us? It's going to be a leading company. It's going to be a great brand. It's going to be somebody who really sincerely wants to invest in the customer experience. Every single company says they do, but you have to find ones who actually do.
Right, right. Who mean it?
You want to find ones that maybe they might not be bleeding edge, but they're, you know, they're not the ones who are looking to make the safest possible choice. They're not the ones that are looking to buy products that were built 20 years ago just because nobody ever got fired for buying, you know, IBM or Salesforce or HP or whoever it is. It's something that's probably a newer product, or maybe you're probably buying it from a smaller company like us, but the risk of buying 20-year-old infrastructure, we think is much higher than the risk of working with something new and with a startup. But you have to find companies who agree with that. And it usually comes down to there's somebody at the company who's pretty senior who really wants to do something new and different. They're not satisfied with just buying the same products their competitors buy, hiring the same people their competitors hire, having the same business processes their competitors have, because then they're just going to end up with the same, their consumer experiences are going to be exactly the same as the rest of their industry. So there has to be somebody who aspires to do something new.
A champion inside the company. So, exactly. You know, I'm curious, oftentimes I think in innovation and actually in business in general, I'd say we see or we think of, you know, startups, entrepreneurial world on one side, and on the other side are big companies, right? And, you know, right. Big organizations, and they're mutually exclusive. The, you know, neither of them shall meet. But you cross that bridge. So I'm just curious kind of how that works, what you learn from each other, why you think that's a good combination where a startup and a large company can actually benefit a ton from each other.
Yeah, and it's like most things in the world, you know, the interesting stuff is all in the gray area between the extremes. So it's not the bleeding edge startup and it's not the stodgy old legacy company. It's how do you find companies that are still big established companies who have limits in how much risk they can take, but you can go into a team or a group or an individual who wants to do a new project, they work with you on it, then they want to expand that through the enterprise. It also means that us as a startup, because we are dealing with serious companies who are spending serious money, even though we're a small innovative company, you know, when we show up at the company, we're going to come wearing a sports coat and a tie, and we're going to have a business case for why they should buy from us. We're going to take uptime and security and compliance and all the kind of stuff that enterprises really care about. We're not going to use the fact that we're a startup and we're a three-year-old company as an excuse not to invest in those things. We're going to say that's what our customer needs, and that's what we're going to, that's the kind of company we're building. And that gets back to the founder market fit thing that I was talking about earlier, where if your company is selling to CIOs, you probably need to have a team that has done that before, at least wants to do that and knows what it will take to do that and hires the right people to do it. And that doesn't mean that that's the right model for everybody. You know, there's other companies that might be better off targeting consumers. There's some that are better off at targeting small business. The kind of company we wanted to create is one that we can go into companies like JetBlue that are big established companies, but still innovative and growing very quickly. That's our market. And that's just the market that we want to go after. It doesn't mean that's the right answer for everybody.
But wouldn't you say too, on top of that, that you are able to bring them a level of maybe outside in innovation and adaptability, even to the larger companies, because, you know, they have to have processes, right? They have to have procedures. They're large. Things, they have to have a standard. Things can't fall through the cracks. But to partner with a startup can give them some opportunity to be a little bit more flexible, because in many ways you can, I don't know if this is the right way to say it, so you tell me, you can do it for them or help them through that process.
Yeah, and it's always a mix. But the thing that I think the thing that's often underappreciated in at least the enterprise software business, which is really what we're doing, is the product itself is extremely important. It has to be innovative. It has to have the features and the scale and the things that make it easy to use and powerful and all the things that our engineering team spends time on. But you never deliver software into a company without a business process change, without a team of people who were doing something a different way are now going to do things a new way. And the change management of how you get them from here to there, which is not just sticking a new product in front of them, it's also having case studies of what previous companies have done. It's having training. It's sitting down with them and working with them. So, for example, we have a customer success team here. It has a lot of people who have worked at consulting firms or have worked at enterprise software companies on the consulting side before, who help companies get from A to B using our solution. And we don't want them to spend the time implementing the software, because that usually means we made the software too complicated to implement if you have to pay a lot of people to come in and implement it. We want them to help with the, how do we get the best use out of it? How do we take what other customers have done, replicated here? How do we take lessons learned from other industries and bring it into this industry? And that's where it becomes very personal very quickly. It really becomes a team of people on both sides working together who both want to build something new together.
I just put myself in the shoes of our launch readers, and I bet you, here's what they're thinking. Oh my God, this is fascinating. And I'm learning so much. And I'm someone who maybe is in a company that needs a little bit more change. And I want to be that driver of it, right? I want to be the driver of innovation. So what advice would you have for them to help them get buy-in to bring that innovation forward? Because I think, to your point earlier, right, it's so helpful when there's a champion internally, but then that champion has a lot of work to do.
Yeah, and this is, I don't have a great answer for this, partially because I'm sympathetic to, inside of large companies, there's issues with budget and team and culture. Like, it's not, everybody isn't equally capable of doing this. I think the one thing I'd probably throw out there is, I think that big companies often tend to think of projects as large capital investments or as large big bang projects. So, oh, if we want to do something innovative, we need to get a big budget. We need to get on an annual planning cycle. We need to get a new team. We need to put together a Microsoft Project Gantt chart that shows all the different steps we're going to take.
You scared me with Gantt chart.
Yeah. And that actually is not how innovation happens. Innovation usually happens with lots and lots of experiments where you take the most successful experiments and double down on them. And those experiments often don't cost a lot of money. They can often be done with the staff and with the tools you already have. So my advice to people is, usually, instead of saying, give me a big budget and in 2 years we're going to deliver something innovative, deliver something innovative today. Do some small project, carve out some budget, find somebody on your team who's capable of taking on something new. Try a few things, pick the one that's working, socialize it, show it to people inside the company. And don't wait until somebody gives you a budget and permission to innovate. Sure, you should generally fight for those things, but prove it by doing something, even if it's something small. And then within your team, at least, set that culture of, we want people to do things that are new and different. We want people to share outside of the group what they did and get other people to adopt it. And if there's a couple of failures along the way, that's to be expected. The whole point of doing things that are new and risky is that only some of them are going to work. But the ones that are going to work are going to be such opportunities that they more than pay for the ones that don't work.
I think that's an incredible piece of advice. I always talk about, you know, build a culture of experimentation, not presentation. Because I think presentation kills innovation, frankly. And I think you said it earlier that you don't really know if the idea is brilliant until you test it. So best way to do that, right, is some duct tape and some scented markers or whatever you have access to.
And I think that's the biggest disconnect, I think, between sometimes, kind of legacy thinking and more kind of innovative thinking, is that legacy thinking is all about it's just getting the project done. It's getting the budget, getting the people, and delivering something. Where often the innovation is more in discovering what the project should be. Almost every startup has a story of, we tried something, it failed, we pivoted, we tried something new, we pivoted, and eventually we found the thing that really took off and really felt like the thing that's going to happen. That's true everywhere. And until you try those things, you can't be sure what are the ones that are going to actually matter.
I want to go off a little bit of a tangent. I really wanted to ask you this question. What's the role for the human factor in technology and innovation? And part of the reason I'm asking is, I think there's a lot of fear around technology is taking my job, as opposed to there's this brilliant intersection where technology can help me do my job or allow me to do or bring different value. And you're in a technology space in a category or in an industry that is human delivered. Sometimes, not always, I guess. I guess sometimes it's tech too. Mm-hmm. But where's that intersection?
So I'll speak specifically about our industry, and then maybe I can talk a little more broadly after that. In our industry, what's been happening is the human factor has probably gotten more important, not less important. For example, nobody calls an airline anymore to get their flight status. They pretty rarely do. They just go on Google or go on the website and they can get that flight status, just with a search, which means that if that customer is contacting you, they probably don't have an easy question like, is my flight on time? They probably have a more complicated question is, hey, I didn't get my seat assignment, or, do you have kosher meals, or whatever the question is. So first of all, the level of problem, when something gets to a person, it's probably a hard question because we've gotten easier at automating the easy questions. The amount of ways people want to contact a company and over different channels keeps going up. The times of day that people want to contact companies has kept going up. And the companies that do this really well tend to just have the best blend of people and technology. So, for example, if somebody emails or calls or sends a social message to one of our customers, we don't want them to spend the first 60 seconds of the interaction saying, what's your first name? What's your last name? What's your account number? What's your email address? We want that to pop up on the screen in front of them so they can simply get on with solving that person's problem, which obviously is more efficient for the company, but it's obviously a better consumer experience because when you talk to a company, they know who you are. That tends to – everybody wins with that. Everybody, the consumer wins and the company wins. And I think in most industries, as you make the workers more efficient, you tend to get more business. The challenge, you tend to be able to roll out more products. The questions get more challenging. So whatever efficiency you gain, you usually make up for just in the fact your business is growing and people come in with more questions. And you don't see a lot of companies who end up making large cuts because they've managed to, make their service a little more efficient because hopefully they're making up for that on growth. And I think in most industries, you're just seeing how people and technology working together ends up being the model. And the people who do well in those companies are the ones who embrace technology and know how to use it. And they tend to spend their time doing what they should be doing, which is actually helping other people and not fighting their tools. And, everybody wins when you do that.
I think in a lot of ways, we're in a time where because technology can do so many of the baseline activities, we actually, as individuals, as humans, have a huge opportunity to bring added value to our teams and to our customers mm-hmm. and to our leaders because we can create a problem solve in a way that a tech can't.
For example, if you look at the banking industry, people predicted that bank tellers were going to go away because of ATMs. There's more bank tellers in the market today than there were the day before the ATM was invented. Huh. But those tellers are doing something different. They're not just handing out cash anymore.
Right. They're actually helping answering questions.
They're helping with loans and with payments and with more complex things. And that's usually what ends up happening. So I think there's an answer to the automation question that I think is a little bit specific around our industry. There's also, if I'm talking to somebody, especially if they're coming out of college or somebody who's just thinking about what's my career going to be? I think in that case, always making sure that what you're doing, no matter what career you're in, first of all, you're just embracing technology. You're trying to learn it. You're trying to make it work for you. You're trying to learn the latest and greatest. I think that's always the right thing to do. And I think working in an industry where technology is an accelerator of your industry and technology is helping your industry, both probably means that you're in an industry that's going to do great. It also means you're probably in a position where you're learning. And even if your job did get automated away, you'd have the skills to do something new. I think that that advice is a little bit independent of anybody's specific predictions about which jobs are going to go away and which jobs are going to grow. And that's always the right thing to do, almost regardless.
Well, and I would add to that and loop it back to what you said earlier. It's about the mindset of how do I leverage that change and that technology to bring more value and to do my job better. And I think people with that mindset will be okay.
Exactly. And that translates into companies too. I think companies, whether they're a startup or whether they're a huge multinational, companies that look at technology and say, how do we use this technology, make our businesses better, help our customers more, they're going to do fine. It's the ones who sit back and kind of hope the technology goes away, or they think that they can wait and maybe be some of the laggards in their industry in terms of understanding how that's going to impact them. Those are the ones that tend to get in trouble. You know, they're the ones who tend to talk about technology as something that's happening to them, as opposed to something that they're using to make a change in their industry. No technology has ever been uninvented. So I think any company that thinks that they can weather the storm terms of impact on their industry, it just never happens.
Well, I think we've seen what happens to them. They're not around anymore, most of them that do that, that have that mindset anyway, right? Because someone else trumped them and they thought this is just a fad, and now we're talking about them in the past tense, I suppose.
Exactly.
Before I ask you my last question, just let's tell everyone, where should people go to connect with you and to learn more about Gladly?
Our website's gladly.com. And, you know, there's a lot on there about our team. I'm on there. My email is just michael@gladly. And that's probably the best place to start.
The last question I want to ask you is around actually something you said to me offline, which was, you know, the riskiest thing you can do is not innovate. And I'd love for you to close out with some advice around why and how you should make innovation important to yourself, your company.
Part of it starts with a mindset. Part of it starts with, first of all, like I said, technology never uninvents itself. So the idea that you have a choice, that you can choose or not choose to participate in that change, you know, you don't have a choice. It's not I'll be innovative or not be innovative, at least if you want to work on something which is growing and which benefits the people working on it. So I think part of it is making sure that a personal mindset, as well as whatever organization you're in, has that acceptance that things are going to keep changing, and even an eagerness to see things change, because change benefits well-run companies. As technology changes, consumer expectations change, good companies do better and better because they're the ones who understand those changes and embrace them. That's partially just a cultural statement. There's also, and I think this gets harder as somebody gets more established inside an existing large company, which is what we talked about earlier. Understanding what's happening on the bleeding edge, understanding what, you know, looking at startups that are getting launched and looking at what design and technology and kind of user behavior principles they're leveraging. You can go on sites like Product Hunt, which is a great site for just new and launching interesting products. Lots of discussions, especially about software products and some hardware products. Reading blogs about the tech industry, following, there's a lot of just great venture capitalists and entrepreneurs who blog and write books about these things. Really that, and it doesn't necessarily mean startups specifically. It's more about just new technologies and new ideas. I think being literate on those things and assuming that whatever is going to impact your company today, even if you're at a big company, is something that some small startup is working on today in Silicon Valley. 3 years from now, that's going to impact you. It's easy to go understand those things, research those things, try those products, and just be curious. I think that's probably the macro advice I would give, is just that if you enjoy technology, enjoy watching how it changes society and changes businesses, exercise that curiosity to follow the industry, try new products, and then bring them back into your company and do it soon enough that your company is the one doing the disrupting and not the one being disrupted.
Well, there you said it, right? You can either be the disruption or get disrupted. And I'm pretty sure we can all agree that getting disrupted usually doesn't feel good and doesn't put you in a good position.
Exactly.
You want to be the one doing the disrupting.
Yeah.
Mike, thank you so much. I learn a ton every time I talk to you, and this was no different. So I so appreciate you being on the show.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Don't tune out yet. I want to tell you something before you go. Did you hear all the mindset stuff Michael was talking about? Being an entrepreneur isn't just about, you know, getting VC money and a new logo or putting out a new product into the world. It's a way of thinking about where the gaps in the marketplace are and how you can actually fill them. Doesn't matter if you're in the C-suite, front lines, or home office. These are lessons we can all use to be more innovative and drive value. Now, I would encourage you to go onto our website, go to launchstreet.com, link is in the show notes, and check out a few of our vlogs about being more innovative and entrepreneurial. I think it's going to give you way more insight to how you can be that rock star innovator, no matter what you do. All right, I'm all tongue-tied, but Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.